From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. 150 years ago tomorrow, Maryland abolished slavery. Overnight, tens of thousands of black men, women, and children knew freedom for the first time in their lives. We talk about what they did next with Ira Berlin, historian at the University of Maryland College Park, and with Christopher Haley, research director for the History of Slavery in Maryland at the State Archives. Then, novelist John Dermot Wood's new illustrated novel, The Baltimore Atrocities, paints a darkly deadpan portrait of the city, full of murders, ghastly deaths, and seedy dives. He talks with Nathan about our struggle with loss. Plus, WBAL-TV sportscaster Jerry Sandusky joins Tom Hall in studio to tell us how who he is has been shaped by his father and football. First News.
I'm producer Jamila Kay. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock. That's on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming at WYPR.org. Now, on with the show.
Good morning. Welcome to Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. In the summer of 1864, a year and a half after Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation declared slaves in the Confederate States to be free, a black woman named Annie Davis, who lived in Bel Air in Harford County, wrote Lincoln a letter. "Dear Mr. President," she wrote, "it is my desire to be free to go see my people on the Eastern Shore. My mistress won't let me. Will you please let me know if we are free?" It would not be until several months later, November 1st, 1864, 150 years ago tomorrow, that enslaved people in Maryland were declared free. How did it happen, and what happened next? Two scholars of emancipation joined me to talk about it. Christopher Haley of the Maryland State Archives, he directs the study of the legacy of slavery in Maryland, and he joins us by phone from Annapolis. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you, Sheila. I'm glad to be here.
Also joining us by phone is Ira Berlin, distinguished university professor at the University of Maryland College Park, a noted expert on the history of slavery and emancipation. His books include Many Thousands Gone and Generations of Captivity. Welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here on a very special day.
Yes, Professor Berlin, the Union and the Confederate armies were still fighting 150 years ago. Why was Maryland, a border state which had stayed in the Union but just barely, why was it rewriting its constitution in the fall of 1864?
Well, by the fall of 1864, slavery was on the ropes in Maryland, and pretty much everybody agreed that the Constitutional Convention, which had met in April, would do what was expected, and that is end the institution of slavery. It was pushed to the ropes by many things, but probably the most important was the enlistment of black men in the Union Army. And once black men became in the Union Army, they made it clear that they would not be slaves, of course, and their family would not be slaves, and the wheels were coming off this long-standing institution of oppression.
But the black men, even though they were enlisted in the Union Army, did not have a vote in that referendum. It was a vote among white voters, correct?
Right.
And very close.
Yeah, they did not have a vote, and of course would not have black people, black men would not have a vote until the passage of the 15th Amendment some years later.
Christopher Haley, how close was that vote?
The vote actually was passed by 375. It was amazingly close. It was the vote prior to that, which would have not ended slavery, was 1,995 against the passage of the vote. And what happened was of the soldiers who came in, literally it was a 10-to-1 vote. And of course, I have the figures right in front of me, otherwise I don't remember it that well, but pretty closely. 2,633 soldiers voted for the Constitution. 263 voted against.
So it was the white soldiers who'd been off fighting the war.
Right, the white Union
who made
soldiers.
The difference.
Exactly.
And Christopher Haley, am I right that about half of the 170,000 blacks living in Maryland in 1864 already were free?
Yes, it was roughly 87,000 were enslaved and 83,000 were free. So it was very much a split split demographic as far as free and enslaved African Americans. In certain counties and cities, you certainly could not assume that any person you saw was black was a slave, especially in Baltimore City, for instance.
Were there some parts of the state, as you look at that vote in 1864, is it clear that some parts of the state were against emancipation?
Very much so.
Where were the pro-emancipation parts of the state? Were the anti?
Well, the pro-emancipation would be Washington County, for instance, voted 2,441 in favor of the Constitution and only 985 against. Now, Prince George's County voted 1,293 against the Constitution and only 149 in favor of, which is kind of amazing when you think today that Prince George's County is one of the most, one could say, liberal and one of the most, the highest affluency of African Americans in the nation today.
Professor Berlin, early in the war, Lincoln was so concerned that Maryland not join the Confederacy, he avoided actions that would antagonize slaveholders in Maryland. Was that no longer the case in 1864?
That is no longer the case in 1864. In other words, once it becomes the Union, the war moves south, and it becomes clear that Maryland slaveholders no longer have the leverage of going off to the Confederacy. The whole dynamics of emancipation changes, and whereas Lincoln was earlier concerned that Maryland might, in fact, join the Confederacy, and the capital of Washington would then be surrounded by Confederate territory. By 1864, of course, this was no longer the case.
So, Christopher Haley, November 1st dawns, 80-some thousand enslaved blacks join 80-some thousand free blacks in Maryland. What changes in their lives and what doesn't change?
Well, to some degree, what changes is just a internally. I mean, there's a psychological, spiritual feeling of I'm free, I am equal to all citizens, all white citizens in this state. So spiritually, there's this boon to their existence and to the possibilities of their livelihood and for their children and for future generations. Now, of course, the reality is that they don't have the right to vote at that point. They don't have really full rights that any other person is by law required to obey. So it's a very rough road to hoe because in one sense, you're asking the same person who enslaved you for free, albeit they're supplying you minimal clothes or minimal lodging so that you can still survive enough to work for them. Now you're saying, now pay me to do this. Now give me shelter so that I can still work for you. And that's not something that, at the strike of a pen, that's not something that changes.
And
but
did
some things do change, and now,
right.
Of course, people can sleep, and under the same roof as their family. That's a critical difference for black people who were dealt out in like so many cards in a deck. Nobody could violate them, could beat them, as of course was commonplace in slavery. They could choose their employer. Of course, as Chris indicated, they might have a hard time getting paid. But in fact, they were now free, and of course they could complain to the law and to the courts and to the local sheriff. And who knows? Sometimes you got a sympathetic response.
We are so close to out of time. Professor Berlin, can you just very briefly tell us about the black apprentices after the Civil War?
Well, one of the ways in which slaveholders tried to turn the clock backwards and to reestablish control over black people was to apprentice their children, and by apprenticing their children, then gain control of them, of adults, of their parents. You want to see your kids, then you better sign this long-term contract with me. Now, this use of apprentice as a way of controlling black people was actually well established in Maryland and used against free black people prior to the war. So we see in both cases one of the differences of emancipation and the process of emancipation in Maryland was the presence of these large numbers of free blacks, that the majority or near majority of the black population was already free.
There's so much more I want to ask you both, and we are flat out of time. I need to ask you both to join us again another time. Ira Berlin is Distinguished University Professor at the University of Maryland College Park and founding editor of the Freedmen and Southern Society Project. He was the lead author of A History, Freedom, A Documentary History of Emancipation. Christopher Hayes directs the Study of the Legacy of Slavery in Maryland projects at the State Archives. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, including links to some of the many, many events this weekend marking the 150th anniversary of emancipation in Maryland. We also have a link to our 2009 conversation about emancipation with Charles Mitchell, editor of Maryland Voices of the Civil War. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us.
I'm producer Jamila Kay. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Thanks for listening.
This is Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast here on 88.1. I'm Nathan Sterner. The Baltimore Atrocities is the title of the latest book by author John Dermot Woods. It's a novel, a dark one, and one unlike any other I have ever read. It's composed of a series of short, tragic stories, the atrocities of the title, all of which are loosely connected to a larger narrative involving missing children and their siblings' search for answers. That story in itself, an atrocity. John Dermot Woods currently spends his days in Brooklyn, New York, but his time spent here in Charm City appears to have affected him deeply. He joins us now to discuss the Baltimore atrocities. John Dermot Woods, welcome.
Thanks for having me today.
So when did you live in Baltimore?
I lived in Baltimore exactly a decade ago. I was a student at the Johns Hopkins writing seminars, and then I stayed around for another year. I was actually only in Baltimore for 2 years, but as you said, it really did leave a mark on me, and I've spent a lot of time there since having moved away from Baltimore.
And the characters only spend 1 year in Baltimore, enough for the entire book. Was there any particular thing that inspired the central narrative, the search for missing siblings?
I think, no, there actually wasn't. There wasn't some sort of real-world event, we'll say, but I do think the idea that of trying to recapture something that was fleeting in a physical sense, really, I think that's what came through in this idea of trying to find a sibling who you may or may not have ever known, but you feel their loss. You know, in the case of this book, both the characters lost their siblings when they were very young. So they're certainly more driven by the idea of the siblings lost than the memory of the people themselves.
The atrocities, the short stories, how many of those tales were rooted in reality?
I guess the answer could be either they all were or none of them were. The idea being that the particular details were almost all fabricated in my mind, yet the ideas of them were based on stories I had heard or kinds of narratives I had heard, not just living in Baltimore, but just over the years, their ideas that I had, and then I crafted them into very specific stories for this book.
The stories came from many places then, but why all Baltimore? Why all set here?
Well, there's a few answers to that. One is that it's kind of interesting about these stories. So many people come up to me and tell me that they've read these stories before, which I find really interesting because
They haven't.
And I think part of it is that I wanted to root it in a specific place. And to me, I chose Baltimore. In a way, it was somewhat arbitrary, except it wasn't. Personally, I wanted to create a specific place and specific details because I wanted people to have that feeling that these were stories that they had heard before. And for me, the natural choice was Baltimore because it was a place that I had lived so briefly, yet seems to occupy such a large place in my mind. And I don't think I'm rare in that experience talking to other people who had spent time in Baltimore. So it seemed natural to me that if I was going to root it in a place that had a large but fleeting presence in my mind, the only city I could do it in was Baltimore.
I want you to read one of the atrocities for us, a story called The Peep Show. And a note to listeners, this story acknowledges the existence of the block.
Yeah, this is one of the more specific references. First in line at The Peep Show. Down on Baltimore Street, after spending several daylight hours at a bar, two college friends who had attended the University of Maryland in their younger years entered an adult entertainment arcade and stood before a live peep show booth. Despite being slightly embarrassed, they both agreed that the women available were remarkably beautiful, and they assured each other that sensuality this rare was worth paying for. They both chose the same small dark-haired woman to watch, and, so as not to seem overly eager or perverse, they also both insisted that the other go first. At last they agreed that the married man, who, as such, was the more desperate of the two, should enter the private booth first. He was astounded by what the woman showed him when they were behind the curtain. He stumbled from the booth delirious with pleasure. But his bachelor friend began to sob once he himself was behind the curtain, a sob that slowly became a violent choking sound. The married man threw open the curtain to find his friend's lifeless body before him, while the naked woman still performed, her eyes closed, unaware of what had happened on the other side of the glass. The man who survived, and whom we met one late night at a bar, said he still often thinks about this moment and wonders what his friend saw in the woman's dance that he himself did not.
First in line at The Peep Show, a story from John Dermot Wood's new book, The Baltimore Atrocities. He's joining us here on Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. As you said, loss is really the central theme of the book. People die at their own hands, at the hands of others. People lose family members, their livelihoods, all sorts of things. So is this really, in many ways, an exploration of how loss affects different people, how different people react to loss?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what it is. I mean, the book is in a way almost of experimenting with losses. There's over 100 of these short episodes that are cut between the major narrative. And the major narrative is obviously about two people who come to befriend each other and spend their life in certain ways together based around nothing in common but a loss.
One of the characters that briefly appears in this book tells the two protagonists, quote, "Once people are lost, they cease to be the people they once were. You might find someone one day, and you might not, but you can't expect that to be the brother or sister you lost." It goes on to say, quote, "The tragedy of losing someone is pursuing a misunderstood search and losing yourself chasing something that does not and cannot exist." Is that to mean that loss is, by its very nature, permanent? Once you've lost something, that thing can never be found?
I think so. I mean, I think that's exactly the idea. And I think, you know, what's being addressed there is that these characters are, they have lost more in their pursuit of that thing which was lost. And I think that that can happen, that people can become so driven by regaining something that's gone and that can really never be restored, that they'll begin to lose more of their life and opportunities. Or on the other hand, there can be some beauty in that pursuit. Something can come out of that. But either way, it's something new, I think.
At one point, Barney, the narrator, starts going to people's funerals. And at the last one he attends, the daughter of the deceased tells him to stop doing so, quote, "not because it's disrespectful to the mourners, but because you'll lose yourself in it. It's too easy," she says, "to define yourself by death and by loss." By the end of the book, Barney is on the path of trying to not define himself by loss. Thomas, his companion, on the other hand, is on the opposite path. What are we to take away from that?
Well, I mean, I don't know that I could give a general prescription for how we should live and how we should deal with loss, but I do think that there is certainly the temptation once we have experienced tragedy or loss to make that the thing that defines us and to make that the thing that gives a mission to go on. And at times that pursuit can be overwhelming or can consume us. And I think the idea here is that Barney is trying to, when he can't define himself by one loss, he's trying to replace it with other losses. And I think that what he's discovering through the book is that perhaps this is a search that won't have an end. You know, loss leads to more loss. And I think at least in this case, and maybe in some of my own experience, that is the result of pursuing things that aren't there.
In one of the final lines of the book, Barney says that he is confident in his resolve to stay away from Baltimore. Now, I should note to listeners that you are conducting this conversation by remote from New York. Are you similarly confident in your resolve to stay away?
No, absolutely not. I mean, as time goes on, my resolve to return to Baltimore becomes greater and greater. I mean, Baltimore has changed a lot, obviously, in the 10 years since I've been gone, but I've been back at least once every year, including times when I was living out of the country. I still made it back. My last book was a book of comics, which was published by Adam Robinson's Publishing Genius Press. So I spent a lot of time down there, which is out of Baltimore. And I have a lot of friends who are writers in Baltimore. And I have great affection for the city. I try to find any excuse at all possible to get to Baltimore.
And any excuse is a good excuse, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Author John Dermot Woods. His latest book is called The Baltimore Atrocities. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Ethan. I really appreciate it.
You can find out more about the book online at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Nathan Sterner. Our show continues in a moment. Stay with us.
Producer Jamila Kay. Go to our website to learn more about a segment you just heard, check out our audio archives, or to join in the conversation yourself. You can also make a pledge to support local programming like Maryland Morning. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
And good morning, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. It's Maryland Morning. Glad you're with us. Jerry Sandusky is my guest this morning. He's the sports director at WBAL Television and the play-by-play announcer for the Baltimore Ravens on the Ravens Radio Network. Earlier this year, he published a poignant and moving memoir of growing up as one of five children of John Sandusky, who played for the Cleveland Browns and the Green Bay Packers, and who went on to a long coaching career with the Baltimore Colts, the Philadelphia Eagles, and the Miami Dolphins. Jerry's memoir is a touching tribute to his dad and a compelling chronicle of how a family coped with the pressures and perks of professional football. Jerry, it's good to have you here.
Great to visit with you today.
So give us a thumbnail sketch of your dad.
So John, my dad was this larger-than-life figure. He was the Rock of Gibraltar, a huge man, 6'1", 300, played in the NFL back before they did weightlifting, you know, just grew that big. And he always had this huge presence about him. He wasn't just, you know, a man or a father. He was a force of nature. You know, we called him Big John behind his back until we were all adults. And he just had this immense presence and just ability to give you a look, and that was the essence of the conversation. And part of what I explore in this book is how men of that era raised the next generation of men, teaching us how to be men without using many words.
You were in a family of five kids. Was the family a team? Was your dad the coach of the Sandusky team?
You know, he was probably he was the law of the team. But my mom was the axis of the team. One of the things you learn in coaches' families is the mom is the glue that holds it all together, because the dad's working so much. And you grow up kind of in fear of your father and knowing that he's the law, and that the law is invisible at times, but it's there. It's kind of the invisible fence. But really, your mom was, if there was a coach, it was your mom, because she knew what your father needed to hear and what he did need to hear. She was the arbiter of all things, and she was really the voice of wisdom and everything.
Yeah, the gatekeeper, as
absolutely.
It were.
Yeah. And that's not unique to my family. You know, you talk to coaches' families. There's only two types of coaches' wives in this world, and those are great ones and ex ones. And my mom was a great one.
Your mom passed away actually before your dad.
That very young.
Incredible shock to the family.
58 years old.
And how do you think your dad coped with that loss? Because at that point he was still working.
I think the word lost was the right word. It was it's part of what I chronicle in the book, is that you are prepared for many things, I think, in life naturally. You are prepared to see your parents die. You are prepared to bring children into the world. You're prepared to get married. You're not prepared to see your father get remarried. At least I certainly wasn't. And so I was starting my broadcasting career at that point in his life as my mom died. My dad just said, just keep living with me. So can we bachelored it together? And I watched him go through that year transition where he was lost. He didn't know how to do laundry. He didn't know how to cook. I barely knew how to cook. I used to make this big pot of spaghetti every Sunday night. And we ran out of that.
That would be for the week.
That was it. You know, again, by Thursday, we're eating out on our own. And so I watched him struggle through this. And then I watched him remarry. And it was an enormously challenging transition to watch my father, a member of the greatest generation, be that lost. And I think because he was so lost, you know, I explore in the book how he chose his next wife, who was very different than my mother, and who I didn't necessarily feel all that good about. But, you know, that's as much about me as it was about him.
Yeah. Your family, no stranger to tragedy on all sorts of levels. Your brother Joe died of an injury apparently related to football.
Yeah, he died. He was 17. I was 17. He was 19. He was a sophomore at Tulsa, and he was a gifted athlete. He was the one of the five kids who was going to be a pro athlete. And he had a cyst on his shoulder caused just from rubbing against his shoulder pads. And the pneumococcus germ got in through there. And instead of going to his lungs, went to his heart and killed him overnight. You know, he called home one night. He thought he broke his ribs in the previous day's game. And then he died on a Tuesday, you know, after calling us. And so all of a sudden, you know, you're a senior in high school. My dad's in the prime of his career. My mom's a young woman at 51 at that point. And it literally one day your whole world blows up. And I watched, you know, this, I lived through this, and I've seen it in other people's lives. And all of a sudden, the things that are so important are just a shell of what importance once was.
But your dad, of course, kept going to the games, kept going to practice. I mean, the season
coached,
didn't end.
Right, yeah. He coached the week my brother died, and we encouraged him to, because, you know, we were all lost. You know, and it was the first time I saw my dad cry. It was the first time I saw my father be lost. You know, that's a staggering thing for any young man to see his father lost and not know what the answers are. You know, it undermines your belief in religion, you know, what you think is right and wrong, what you think is north and south. It just blows everything up. And so it was, you know, watching my parents, how they had dealt with tragedy. My father worked more. My mother became more spiritual. And gradually there became a divide. And I say that with no criticism whatsoever, because it was a time when there was no family counseling. Nobody went to talk it out. And they didn't talk. You know, they each dealt with their own pain silently.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. My guest this morning, Jerry Sandusky. His book is called Forgotten Sundays, A Son's Story of Life, Loss, and Love from the Sidelines of the NFL. Your dad died of Alzheimer's disease. He was 80 years old, former player in the NFL, head injuries and, you know, traumatic brain injuries, very much in the news. You cover it all the time as a journalist and a reporter. What's your take on the relationship between these head injuries and the violent hits that these players are taking now and who took them in your dad's era? And these brain conditions.
I don't think there's any doubt at a common sense level that there's a link between, you know, the concussive nature of the sport and long-term physical problems. But I think we're being limited in our view that men suffering concussions automatically leads to Alzheimer's. If that were the case, every single person who played football would wind up with Alzheimer's. We know that's not the case. In writing this book, I kind of came to the realization in talking to so many other people that I believe Alzheimer's has a spiritual link to it as well. For my father, he coached high school after he got done coaching in the NFL, and then because of an accident, the doctors wouldn't let him coach anymore. And within 6 months, he had Alzheimer's, which got me down the trail of thinking and exploring that the spiritual component to Alzheimer's is that when a person loses his or her sense of identity, of sense of self, of purpose, of why I'm here, of who I am, once you're cut adrift, it's and you feel forgotten, it's almost inevitable that you too will soon forget. And so I fully support all of the research into concussion. I fully support all of the safety initiatives, and I think they need to continue that. But I think we have to be careful not to take away all physical interaction and all contact from sports, because this is not just a physical condition. It's a spiritual condition, and I think we're being nearsighted if we expect our doctors and our scientists alone to solve the problem.
Speaking of identity, in 2011, a fellow named Jerry Sandusky was indicted and found guilty of doing horrible things to children in Pennsylvania. He was an assistant coach at Penn State. What was that like for you to happen to have just completely serendipitously the same name of a child molester?
What are the odds?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's how the book starts. Is you know, the day that I learn what's going on and this crazy twist of events of, wait a second, here's a guy who has this name that sounds identical to mine, works in football, and all of a sudden everybody who hears my name connects me to this guy for understandable reasons. It's been a complete upside down, inside out experience that I just couldn't at first get my head wrapped around. But I had to in a hurry because it impacted my family at such a visceral level. You know, my kids were dealing with it at school. My wife couldn't go to the grocery store without coming home in tears. One night we're watching Saturday Night Live and there's a Jerry Sandusky routine on it. And she just, you know, bursts into tears and folds into my arms.
Because there were people who were confusing you two.
Absolutely.
They thought you were that guy.
Absolutely.
You were getting hate tweets and stuff.
Hate mail, death threats. I mean, there was a point at which I was getting hundreds of hate tweets an hour on Twitter. And look, I understand. I understand the confusion. I get it. But I had to deal with it, and I had to develop a strategy for my family to deal with it. And I drew on something that I learned from my father after Super Bowl III. He was an assistant with the Baltimore Colts. They lose to the Jets, the biggest upset in NFL history. The next day at school, I get into a fight because somebody was bad-mouthing my father. And so he pulls me aside, and he said, look, because of this, you're going to find out there are a lot of jerks in the world, and you can't punch them all without becoming the biggest jerk. And I thought at the time my father was just trying to get me through third grade. I had no idea he had given me the wisdom to get my family through this issue that came up 4 decades later when I had to teach my kids that people are going to say bad things about me. Don't react to it. Because the lesson I taught them that I had learned from this whole episode was hating is always about the hater. It's not about you. I can't control what other people say, think, do. All I can control is how I respond.
There are some amazing moments in this book. One of my favorites is a scene where your mom is sewing jerseys for the Miami Dolphins to make them tighter so that tacklers can't grab the cloth and bring down the runners. Did stuff like that just sort of happen all the time? You literally lived your childhood on the sidelines of NFL football.
And everybody had a role in it. You know, like my mom was a gifted seamstress, and so when they outlawed the ability, they used to spray like WD-40 on jerseys so guys couldn't grab it. Well, once they outlawed that, somehow my mom and dad, through a conversation, figured out mom's a great seamstress. She would come to training camp, and she would tailor each player's jerseys. And that's how I knew which guys were making the team, because they weren't going to tailor the jerseys of guys who weren't going to make the team.
So you had scoops even
right,
at that
absolutely.
Age.
Absolutely. Before I was in the media, I knew how to figure out scoops. And so everybody in the family had a role. My brother and I, you know, we worked on the sidelines. You were in the locker room. And I always say, look for the kids now. If you go to a game on Sunday, look for the ball boys and the ball girls. They're right at the line of scrimmage. They're usually wearing a little vest. They're easy to identify. And nobody sees them. And that's why it's such an important role, because a ball boy is allowed to go anywhere in the stadium.
Yeah.
You have total access, and nobody sees you. You are the invisible fly on the wall. It's wonderful, and it was an amazing way to grow up.
Best source in the whole stadium.
Oh, it was
right?
Fabulous.
Let's talk a little bit about the Ravens. Right after we lost this game last week against Cincinnati, Mr. Roethlisberger in Pittsburgh ended up scoring 51 points against, of all teams, the Colts. Two questions. Are they going to wear those horrible uniforms again, the Steelers?
No, thank God they're not wearing those bumblebees.
The bumblebee thing.
There's you think you hate them as a fan, as a play-by-play guy. They're a nightmare because I can't see the number. It's like watching a TV test pattern for 22 people running around. But by the end of those games, when they wear those numbers, every play-by-play guy has a migraine headache.
Are we going to beat them? I mean, and if we don't, what happens? We're both 5-3. How do you see the matchup?
Look, the matchup is the way every Ravens-Steeler matchup turns out. I could give you a prediction that's meaningless, because the only thing you know about these games is probably going to be a 3-point outcome. Who has the upper hand on it? I can't tell you because they're unpredictable. But the stakes are so high, the motivation will be so high. I think you're going to see a tight game because you leave this game with a win, you're 6-3. You have one more game before the bye week. You have a shot to go into the bye week at 7-3. You're in good shape. You lose this game, you're 5-4. You're on a 2-game losing streak. You're liable to go into the bye week 5-5. And so the swing is staggering.
Huge,
so
yeah.
It keeps everybody on edge, which is one of the things that sets this game up so high. And Tom, I'm not blowing off your question about who will win, but I don't make predictions for this simple fact. A couple of years ago, my wife and I celebrated our 25th wedding anniversary.
Congratulations.
And so, thank you. And so she had set up this really special getaway to a resort in Mexico, and it was going to be in January. And she says to me in December, hey, what are we going to do about this? The Ravens might make the playoffs. I said, honey, if you watch this team play this year, they're going to be one and done. Don't worry about it.
Don't worry.
They won the Super Bowl.
Yeah, right. Nice
so,
call.
Right. So I don't make predictions anymore.
Well, you do write really, really compelling and wonderful books.
Thank you very much. Writing's a great passion of mine.
Well, this is a really fun read, and I appreciate your coming in this morning.
Pleasure being with you.
Jerry Sandusky, he's the voice of the Baltimore Ravens, the sports director at WBAL in Baltimore, and the author of Forgotten Sundays, A Son's Story of Life, Loss and Love from the Sidelines of the NFL. The Ravens play the Steelers on Sunday Night Football. Now, I am contractually obligated to encourage you to tune into Echoes on Sunday night right here on WYPR. But if you're inclined to ignore me, and let's face it, many, many people are, or if you happen to just not be in the mood for new age music on Sunday night, here's my suggestion. Tune into NBC, tune the TV sound off, and listen to Jerry Sandusky, Stan White, and Kadri Ismail call the game. I'm just saying. Maryland Morning is an original production of Your Public Radio, WIPR, in Baltimore. The show is produced by Matt Purdy and Jamila Kay. Nathan Sterner directs and engineers. We've got production help from Payam Agagasum and Elizabeth Sherwood. Our coffee is from Zeke's Coffee. Our theme music is from Clean Cuts, except for this theme music. Our website is wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Happy Halloween. Be extra careful driving when the kids are out trick-or-treating tonight. And have a great weekend.